You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in today for Carrie Miller. I hope everyone is having a wonderful holiday season. What I want to do today is talk money. Specifically, household personal finances. The end of a year is a good time to review household finances and plan for the new year and beyond. There's also a great deal of uncertainty now about the U.S. economy and where it's heading. Record economic expansion, sliding into recession, slower growth, but no downturn. Many major stock market indices are near or in bear market territory, meaning down by 20% or more. Now, you can't get rid of the uncertainty. You can't control the timing of the business cycle or the direction of the stock and bond markets. But what you can do is examine your individual household circumstances and make adjustments. What we're going to do today with two experts is forget forecasting, hazardous to your wealth, and discuss steps you can take to improve household finances for good times and bad. Think smart financial planning. But first, let me give out the number. We'd love to hear from you. Are you dealing with too much credit card debt? Wondering if now is a good time to buy a home? What is your financial resolution for the new year? Give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll-free, 800-242-2828. And online, it's talk at nprnews.org. My guests are Jaquette Timmons, a self-described financial behavioralist and author of Financial Intimacy, How to Create a Healthy Relationship with Your Money and Your Mate. And she joins us from Brooklyn, New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. And we're also joined by Ramona Ortega. She is the founder and CEO of My Money, My Future, a financial tech company targeted at millennials. Glad you could be with us.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. And you're also in Brooklyn, right?
I am.
So this is a little bit of a Brooklyn reunion.
Money from Brooklyn this morning.
Yes, because I used to live in Brooklyn, in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. So we can have a little bit of a Brooklyn reunion here.
That's awesome.
All right. Jaquette, I want to start off with you. What is a financial behaviorist?
A financial behaviorist is one that helps you back into managing your money through the lens of your behavior and your choices. And so it doesn't mean that the numbers don't matter, because obviously they do, but it puts a spotlight on why do you do the things that you do, what's motivating your behavior, what's motivating your choices. And the more you understand that, the better you can have more of an impact on how the numbers actually shape up. So it's turning the focus, if we look at the money equation, from just trying to crunch the numbers, because if managing money were all about the math, we wouldn't even need to have this conversation. But looking at, you know, let's go beyond the numbers and tap into your emotions and your psychology and understand more about what drives what you do, so that you can identify your patterns and switch those patterns where it would be most beneficial to you.
So why did you get drawn to this side of the money management business? Because most people get into money management or personal finance. I mean, they like the math.
I do too. however, you know, I am of an age where I actually saw up close and personal the crash of 87. It was my second year on Wall Street. I was at Bankers Trust, which is now Deutsche Bank. And having a chance to, you know, see people's reaction to that one day, and seeing how there were some folks that if they could have opened the window, and I'm not exaggerating, they would have jumped out of it because of how much money they lost for themselves and for their clients. And then on the other hand, there were people that were really, really calm. And behavioral economics and behavioral finance is not a new discipline. It's been around for many years. But I didn't have the language back then to describe it that way. All I knew is, one event happened, but these two ends of the spectrum are responding very differently behind that. And I became so curious as to why. And then amplified with that is my time spent in the private bank managing money for high net worth individuals, and just kind of coming coming to the conclusion that just because someone has a few more commas and a few more zeros behind those commas that separate them for others on the lower end of the income spectrum and the wealth spectrum, at the end of the day, people all have the same concerns. They want to make sure that they are in control of their money. They want to make sure that they're making the best possible choices. And a lot of that stems from mindset and behavior.
So, Ramona, there's been this explosion in financial technology firms, fintech firms. So what drew you to fintech?
Yeah, I think much like we were just talking about, I actually spent time on Wall Street as a litigator. And so I was working on Madoff at the time. And I realized that when I spoke to a number of my colleagues, and I would suggest that these are women of color working at big law firms, and I would ask them about their money and what they were doing with it. And often, too often, I got sort of responses, well, I don't know much about money. I don't really think about it, or my husband handles it. I even got a response that my father handles it. And I said, you know, there's a real knowledge gap here, and there's people are looking for answers. They don't feel confident. And this is even, you know, women that are highly educated. And I said, there's a real gap in fintech right now for people that are like myself, who didn't grow up with money, who didn't really learn much about money management in my community and didn't have resources. And I was looking at what fintech was offering, and there were lots of apps geared towards millennials. There were not a lot of apps that were taking on the nuances, though, of particularly communities of color. And that's, I would say, our emphasis at My Money, My Future. We're really trying to close the racial wealth gap. And so we've taken sort of a perspective of how do you understand people's communities and their relationships to money. And I think much like we were talking about earlier with behavioral economics, there's nuances. Women have nuances with money. Communities of color have nuances. And so how do we address those so that we can give the best financial advice so people can build wealth in their community and feel really empowered? So that's what drew me to fintech, is the ability to use technology.
Okay. So let's
millions of people.
Yeah. So is there something that particularly works when you're reaching out to different communities?
Absolutely. I think it's a lot about the message, right? So what we do is really tailor our message to talk about the nuances that particular community might be facing. I mean, millennials, for example, are going to talk about student debt a lot more than anyone else because that's what they're facing.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phone lines, and Mike is on the line from Minneapolis. Mike, what is your question?
Good morning. I am curious where you see the housing market going as far as timing to buy a house or not buy a house. It's all about supply and demand, and the prices are going so high. Do you anticipate that continuing?
Okay. So, housing, as you mentioned, housing prices have gone up a lot. Now they've been down recently. Housing market's not looking particularly good. But Jaquette, what are some of the fundamental questions people should be asking themselves before they buy a house?
So I think one of the foundational things is to keep in mind that when we say housing market, we tend to think of that very broadly, and we need to really think of it in a more micro level, not macro. So the housing market here in New York is probably very different than the housing market in Minneapolis. So that's the first thing, like really be.
Well, there's a lot more zeros in your market.
Yeah, that is very true. Very, very true. But my point there is be attuned to what's going on in your area and be mindful of what's going on big picture, but you want to focus on what's going on in your particular area. The other thing is understand, why are you looking to buy this home? Is this a primary residence? Is it for investment purposes? How long do you plan on staying there? So, of course, you know, just like everything, when you buy it, you want to make sure that you're getting it for the best possible price. So as the seller, you want to get the highest price. As the buyer, you want to get the lowest price possible. But it really depends upon what is your purpose. And if your purpose is to be there as your primary residence for 30 years, you probably have a little bit more flexibility in what that that sweet spot is in terms of that price than someone who's looking at that as purely a real estate investment play. So you really need to understand what's your purpose for buying that home.
And don't you also think there's a lot of pressure on people to extend themselves to buy a home? Once you start looking, then all of a sudden real estate agents are telling you, well, if you don't get this bid in now, the prices may go higher. Your relatives are saying, you know, come on, aren't you going to be an adult? And that it's important to be able to say, no, here's my price and I can't go above this.
Yes, I think financial self-awareness in that regard is absolutely key. You need to know what you are willing to spend in terms of your down payment. You need to understand all of the ancillary costs that come with the home and whether or not you have the financial capacity to meet those unexpected costs. And if anything feels uncomfortable, that's an invitation to explore whether or not you have the bandwidth to be able to withstand a financial surprise. And if you don't feel comfortable, that's an indication to just press pause.
Okay. Ramona, we have a question from Jennifer, and Jennifer's in Oakland, California, and she has a question on a topic that you touched on. Jennifer?
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a new student loan. I returned to graduate school recently, and interest rates are much higher than they were my first time around, and I'm wondering what's a good way to refinance that? And a second part of that question is I could potentially pay the loan off, but I'm looking to have flexibility for a property investment, and I'm wondering if I'm better off almost paying the loan off or refinancing.
Well, before I toss your questions to Ramona, what are you getting your degree in?
I have a Master of Fine Arts. For teaching. Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. Ramona, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so this all is going to really depend on interest rates and the interest rates on your initial student loans versus the interest rates that you're going into for your grad school debt, right? Oftentimes the advice is that you don't want to pay off your student loans if you have cash, your student loans are below a certain percentage, right? So right now, I think they're about 5% for new loans. If you were back in the day and had those 4% or even some 3%, you don't want to trade those in and pay those off. You would rather be using some of that cash for either an investment or to put towards your retirement, emergency savings, things like that. Because one of the reasons is that if you have sort of student debt coming in, or if you have high credit card interest rate loans, those are the ones you want to pay off first. So it's a fine balance. If you have good credit, SoFi obviously is a big refinancing fintech firm and often gives very good rates. Look around, see what the rates are, and do that comparative analysis. But most of the time, if you've had loans for a while and you had a good interest rate, keep paying those and pay chunks down. But if you have cash that you're looking to make for an investment, I would use that for an investment.
Jaquette, anything to add?
Yeah, I think this is a perfect opportunity to just kind of tap into this notion that not all debt is bad. And I think sometimes the desire to be quote-unquote debt-free prompts us to do things that are not as strategic as what Ramona just kind of laid out. So for those people that have this idea that debt is bad, I think it's an invitation and time to kind of take a step back and really look at what is the debt that you have, what's the purpose of that debt, what's the profile of that debt, and maybe a better use of your resources is to keep paying that debt down, but save up some cash so that you have some liquidity available to you in the event that you need it and or invest it.
And one of the things, and for both of you, I'll start off with you, Ramona, but one of the things that strikes me, I was looking at some numbers, and if you look at the age group 20 to 24, I think it's in that range, you know, their monthly unemployment rate is like around 10%. And that's because you leave jobs, you lose jobs, you're trying to figure out what it is you want to do. You have this very high unemployment rate. As you get older, the unemployment rate goes down. So one of the things I always wonder in these questions about paying down debt and savings is recognizing what stage of life you're in, and that early in your career, you know what? Savings is really valuable because you want to be able to leave a job you don't want to be in, or, you know,
that's right.
What do you think, Ramona?
Oh, absolutely. I talk about this as like your opportunity fund. First of all, I always say, you know, it's not about how much you invest, it's how long you invest, right? So that really urges people at the earliest age to start investing in either a Roth or your 401k, because that's going to be your opportunity fund, maybe even when you're 35, right? So if you're starting when you're 21, by 35, you're going to be able to say, do I want to use this money to buy a home? Do I want to use this money to start a business? Do I want to use this money for a life event? And I think that's really key, especially in this time where people are not staying in jobs, like you said, for very long. And you want to have that ability to sort of break free and make some choices of your own.
Jaquette?
You know what? Ramona wrapped it up really
okay.
well.
Okay, I figured, yes. So let's go to Beth in St. Paul. Beth, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And your question or comment?
I am changing this year. I'm taking the leap and moving from a traditional health care plan at my employer to a high deductible. And
okay.
I have.
So this is what's called a health savings account plan?
Yes, right. Okay. And I have some chronic conditions that mean that I unpredictably sometimes have years where I will hit that out-of-pocket max, which is about $3,000 on the plan that I'm in.
Okay.
So my question is, I have that in savings. And I will be fully funding my HSA this year, but that money won't be available right away, obviously. My understanding is that if I pay for things out of my savings and keep my receipts, I can reimburse myself from that HSA either now or sometime in the future. And I'm wondering whether it makes more sense to use the savings I already have to pay any medical expenses that I have this year and let the HSA build up as sort of a separate savings account, or whether I should pay myself back as I build up the HSA funds.
Jaquette?
So if I'm following the sequence of events, I would say pay yourself back, because that means you have access to those funds more immediately to either decide to reinvest, if you will, in your healthcare savings account, or reinvest that elsewhere. One of the things that you want to, as often as possible, kind of maximize is A, your cash flow and the liquidity of that cash flow. So it sounds like if I understand the sequence correctly, with the way that you've described it, one option gives you more money later on and another option gives you more money currently. Is that a great way of summarizing it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay, so I would maximize the option that gives you more money currently, because that's stuff that's money that you can make choices with now that may help you later on down the road, as opposed to waiting for that money to be available to you later on down the road.
Ramona, anything to add?
Yeah, the two things I would add to that is, if you have a credit card with points and you have that money to pay, so you've set aside perhaps that credit card where you can be gaining the points on it while you're paying for those additional expenses, because you know you have the money to pay that off. And so if you can pay it off monthly and get those points, that's one way to use that. The other one is, if you have the cash, or if you're paying yourself back, putting that into at least a 2% savings account, which now with the federal the hike, we have lots of online savings accounts that are at 2% and above.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling. So I want to ask Ramona, I'll ask you to start off with you, and then same question to Jaquette. So this is the time of year when we think about financial resolutions. I was looking at the Fidelity annual list of top financial resolutions, and I think it's the 10th annual, and it has not changed for 10 years. There's, you know, save more, pay down debt, spend less. So part of me feels, okay, is this financial resolutions a waste of time? Or, you know, there's that famous quote from Ben Franklin that I've always liked, that and he said, be always at war with your vices, at peace with your neighbors, and let each new year find you a better man. And, you know, in each of us, there's kind of a Ben Franklin at work at this time of year. So what do you think, Ramona?
Yeah, look, so what I will say, it's a good time to do a 360, right? I mean, we're being reflective in the new year, and money is a huge part of stress and a huge part of, like, sort of how you think about planning your year. So for me, it's really about just take that 360. I often pull my credit report at the end of the year to see what I need to do and going into the new year. you know, just take a sort of where am I at with my portfolio? Where am I at with my investments? You know, what kind of savings do I want to have this year? What am I saving for this year? I think it's just it's a good time to do it. So you're already in that mindset, because so much of what this is about is mindset, like Jacquette will talk about, I'm sure.
Well, Jacquette?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I have a two-part and a little bit of a probably different viewpoint than folks might expect for a financial question. So I would say, in terms of doing a year-end review, before you talk about resolutions, do a year-end review and have that be based upon, you know, looking back over your shoulder, what worked, what didn't work, what lessons did you learn, and do that generally as it pertains to your life, and then also as it pertains to your finances. And with regards to your finances, and this also presupposes that to some degree you were tracking it, but track. How much did you save? How much did you invest? How did you spend your money? How much did you earn? And when you're doing that, what you're looking for are patterns. Again, patterns of behavior, patterns of choices, patterns that you might be able to identify in terms of your decision points. Because what's the point of moving forward if you're not being intentional about that? And so that review kind of helps you get a sense of what have I done in the past? Is what I've done in the past working for me? And if not, what might I want to change? And one key thing here that I think is important that some people overlook when it comes to tracking, especially on the spend side, is how much of that went toward your goals. People always say, oh, I have X goal, but they don't take the time to figure out what the financial component of that goal is. And when you look at their banking statements, their credit card statements, their saving statements, and then you say how much of that went toward a particular goal, there's often silence. So for me, the year in review is, in general life, what did you do? What worked? What didn't? What are the lessons? And the same for the financial, but especially with the tracking, looking at how much of what did I spend go toward my goals.
And do you think this is a good argument for getting your taxes done early? And by the way, maybe doing your taxes yourself, because if you haven't been tracking during the year, when you do your taxes, in essence, that's what you do, is you look back over what were my financial circumstances in 2018.
Yeah, I am a proponent of always getting your taxes done professionally. So I just think that that's the smart way to go. And in terms of doing it early, I just think it's beneficial because it just gets it off of your to-do list. I have no choice. My tax deadline is March 15th because my company is an S Corp in New York State. So there's that. But I'm always a fan of do it early so you can get it off of your to-do list. And in those instances, hire a professional.
And what do you think, Ramona?
Yeah, so I think I like doing mine early because it also just gives me a sense of what, you know, what I need to do for planning for the next year. So in it, the financial 360 gives you a sort of sense of what it is that you've spent on. I use mostly fintech apps, so there are plenty of budgeting apps to keep that tracking under control, which is great. I would suggest using, you know, anything like Simple or Mint or any of these online platforms for budgeting. It allows you to look at what you've spent and then prioritize for the future. You know, also if you're a freelancer, and many millennials now are getting 1099 income, if you've made over $600, you're going to have some freelance income. So you want to think about that. And now there's the 20% sort of deduction for freelancers and sole proprietors and others. So those are good things to think about your money. It's a good time to pull your credit, look at your spending, and sort of figure out what you need to do for the next year.
If you're just joining us, I'm Chris Farrell, in today for Carrie Miller. Our topic is financial planning for the new year. My guests are Jacquette Timmons, a financial behaviorist, and Ramona Ortega, founder of My Money, My Future. And let me just give out the number one more time. What is your personal finance question for the new year? Have you had success in the past with your New Year's resolutions, and how did you do that? Give us a call, 651-227-6000, or toll-free, 800-242-2828. And let's go to Craig in Minneapolis. Craig?
Hi, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
I have my goal has been to be debt-free for a long time, and for several years I have been. I went to buy a car, and to get more money off the car, I could take out a small loan, and which I decided to do instead of paying the full price for it, and found that my credit score is zero.
Okay. So why is it so important to you to be debt-free?
I guess a left brain, right brain thing.
Okay. So, Ramona, what do you think?
I'm trying to understand. So your credit score is now zero? Is that right?
Yes.
Because you just haven't been taking out any, you just basically don't have a credit score, right? Because you haven't been taking out any debt.
Well, I have a credit card that's been going. I pay it off every month. But since about 3 or 4 years ago, I've paid off all my mortgages over the years and any other loan that I've had out. So I haven't been using credit per se other than this card since.
I'm Ramona, when
you shouldn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you don't have anything reporting. What I would do if I were you would go get your annual credit report. It's free, and by federal law, everyone's allowed to get their credit report for free, and you can do that online at annualcreditreport.com. I would make sure, because there should be some reporting. If they're not reporting your payments, you should give a call to the company, and they should be reporting those payments, especially if you have a car loan. It sounds like you should have actually very good credit,
right,
in fact, if you've paid off your mortgages and you have, you know, very little sort of debt to income ratio. It sounds like you do. You should have a very good credit score. And remember, being debt-free doesn't give you a great credit score. Actually using credit and debt responsibly gives you a good credit score. There's sort of a 30% ratio. They want to see that you're using some of the credit line that you have and you're making payments, and that actually helps to improve your credit score. So if they're not reporting, make sure they're reporting those good payments, and then also just pull your credit report and your credit score again, because that doesn't sound right.
Yeah, because Craig, one of the things is the standard piece of advice out there is, even if you don't want to be in debt, use your credit card, pay it off full at the end of the month, and the credit card credit scores don't care if you pay it off at the end of the month in full or keep some going. You should have a good credit score if you're meeting that bill month after month after month. So let's go to Brad. And Brad, you're in Eagan, I believe?
Yes. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a question about tax due and charitable giving. I'm going to have a pretty large tax bill coming up from a company that I was part of that sold. As I understand it, I can pay 110% of what I paid in tax last year, I believe by January 15th, and safe harbor till April when taxes are due, pay the remainder then. That's the first part of my question. Is that correct?
All right. And the second
one? I would highly recommend, again, having that conversation with your CPA, and preferably one would assume that all CPAs are proficient with tax law and tax liability and tax efficiency, but that's not the case. So I would make sure that your CPA is really proficient in all of those tax-related matters, so maybe a CPA that's also an MST, Masters in Taxation, because that really is a personalized question from a tax liability standpoint, and I wouldn't want to be in a position where, first of all, I'm not a CPA, but I wouldn't want to be in a position where I gave you advice that actually increased your tax exposure. So I think that would be the best route to take.
Yeah, and just to emphasize, this is where Jaquette and I absolutely agree. When I was talking about doing your taxes on your own, that's just a good review looking over the year. Once you start dealing with large chunks of money, you want to be doing a large gift, whatever are sort of particular circumstances that up the ante, then I really do think you need to be with a professional who can look at your circumstances and give you CPA level advice.
Question was,
I agree. There's too many dependability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'd like to donate as much as I can and reduce overall taxes, but keep it all the same total, if that makes sense.
If that's the case, and especially if you want it to go against 2018, you should try to have that conversation with that CPA between this week and Monday, because you'd have to do that donation by the 31st.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I would hang up on us and get in touch with the CPA, which they're probably working right now because it is the end of the year. So, all right. Well, thank you very much, Brad. And let's go.
Hey, Chris, before we go to the next caller, I'd love to be able to just add, with all of the fintech apps, totally am on board and agree with Ramona, you should use them. Make sure, though, that whatever one you use also helps you to track your cash. Because how often are you in a situation where you might go to the ATM machine on a Sunday and you wake up on Tuesday, say you took out $100 on Sunday, you wake up on Tuesday and you have $20 and you have no idea where that $80 goes. So you don't just want to track when you made a withdrawal from the ATM, but what did you do with that money that you withdrew?
Ramona?
Yes, that's true. I think all of them do that. You can make notes and tag the money withdrawal within most of the apps. I also just don't really take out cash. That's just kind of my rule so that I can track everything. I mean, at max, I'll take out $20 just to have on hand, but that's sort of my preference. And most places nowadays, you don't have to.
All right. Let's go to Mankato, and Jesse is on the line. Jesse?
Hi there. Thanks for having my call.
What's your question?
Yeah, so I am a young professional, a couple of years into the workforce, and over the years I've accrued a savings account. It's got about $6,000 in it, and it's obviously not accruing very much interest sitting in my bank savings account. And I was kind of wondering what if there's anything else better that I should be doing with that money. That money is kind of like my rainy day account. If something were to go wrong in my house, break down, or if my truck were to break down, it would need repairs. That's kind of what I would use that money for.
Okay, so the purpose of the money isn't changing. This is your emergency fund, maybe your opportunity fund, but you want it to be available to you.
Yes.
Okay. Ramona?
Yeah. Yeah, so emergency savings account, congrats, because that's awesome that you have that. You want it to be liquid, right, so that you can access it immediately, which means you don't have that many options. What you want to do, though, is put it in the highest interest-bearing account that is possible, right? And so depending on what your bank is offering, for example, Marcus, I think right now, which is a Goldman Sachs company, it's a 2% or 2 and some change. So that's one of the higher sort of bearing interest savings accounts. The problem with putting it into a CD is that it's going to take a couple of days if you need access to it. Keeping it in a liquid sort of, savings account is probably the best option. Now, what you need to do is figure out how much more you need to put into that. You might not want to put too much more in there. I always say you don't want $15,000, $20,000 sitting in a savings account without a good interest rate. So, you know, $6,000 to $10,000 might be the number that you're looking at, and not putting much more in that particular account and investing the additional money.
You know, Jaquette, one of the things about money, and this isn't a critical comment, Jesse, but a lot of times people will have cash and they're thinking, or they're being told, I need to get my money to work harder for me. But as you said, that the purpose is to be there when you really need it. So do you deal with this, Jaquette, when people are looking at what is this money for?
Yes. So I actually love his question because it taps into that, and it taps into, giving your money direction and giving different buckets of it a particular job. So that bucket is for his emergency savings, but he may have another savings account that is for a different purpose or a different bucket. And one of the reasons for, having people go through and list what their goals are and what's the financial component of those goals is if the goal needs to be achieved in anything between 0 to 5 years, that's money that you would absolutely want to keep liquid. And yeah, you're not going to get as high of a return or potential appreciation as if it were invested in the stock market. But at the same time, you know that it's available to you when you need it. And any of your goals, the manifestation of is greater than 6 years, then that's money that you can have and, you know, put that in the stock market, whether it's via individual stocks or mutual funds. So what I always suggest to people is that you don't just have one singular savings account, that you have multiple savings accounts. And sometimes that's for short-term liquidity sort of goals. Another could be, if you don't want to go crazy with them, another could be for midterm goals, and then another could be for long-term goals. And depending upon the time frame, dictates where do you park that money. Is it a high-yielding savings account or a CD that you roll over? Is it in a mutual fund or is it in individual securities?
So let's go to Devaney. Devaney, you're in Brainerd.
Yes, I am.
And your question, comment?
My question is, the other day my boyfriend, he got a phone call, and it ended up being a pretty elaborate scam, which is kind of convincing. But it, during the course of realizing this, he confirmed with the people calling his address and the last four of his social security number. And so I'm just wondering, where do I start making calls to make sure that they're not able to do anything on his credit with that information?
Okay. And what was the scam? If you can briefly describe it.
Yeah, it was a man. He was said he was a police officer calling from Texas, and that they found a vehicle on the Texas Mexico border with drugs and mail in it. And the mail had his address on it. And so they said there's a warrant for his arrest. And he needed to bring some money somewhere, which he pretty much figured that was a scam. But I think the real scam was to get the information, which he didn't really, you know, realize during the time.
Yeah, this is we're in the scam season. I guess every season is scam season. But right now, there are just a lot of them out there. So with this concern, Ramona, what would you do?
So the first thing I would do is report it to the credit bureaus. So the three credit bureaus that you can report to. So that's the first thing. And so that's, that way it's noted on your credit report that there's this potential potential identity there perhaps. And then the second one I would go to is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and report that number. They have a sort of a submission where you can report possible kind of fraud. And so I would report it there as well so that it gets locked into to the database.
And Ramona, would you freeze your credit? In other words, you put a freeze on it and, you know, essentially can't be tapped. It has to be unfrozen before you can you can really borrow.
Yeah. I mean, it depends, right? So the problem is that if you, for example, if you're getting a new credit card right now, or if you're in the process of some kind of a credit check, that might not be feasible, but I would definitely call them up, get your credit report, see track the activity. There's lots of trackers that you can pay for. I usually don't suggest them, but if you're worried about this particular incident, you can track it to make sure you get alerts and see if it's worth freezing your account. Oftentimes, the freezing though can hold things if you've got other things in the works that might cause a problem around delays.
Okay, Jacquette, anything to add?
Yeah, I would do two things. I would also look into certain platforms that actually will track your identity and credit to see if there's any usage on it that you might not be aware of. Because the thing to keep in mind is that even with the credit reporting agencies, their information is delayed by the time they get it. But with the tracking tools, their information is typically real time, so you can get the alert about it. And I would also go to your local police station and see if it may not be possible to file a police report, but to see if it is, because then at least you have that documentation as well to help support your claim should something happen.
All right, let's go to Pamela in St. Paul. Pamela?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. How can we help you?
Well, how about sending some money my way?
Okay, absent doing that.
All right, my question is if you could simply explain the difference between annuities and an IRA versus that.
Okay.
Because I'm thinking of combining some money, and at my older age, what I should do, because one of my IRAs had matured, combine those together or diversify.
All right. So this is the definitional. Who would like to take the difference between an annuity and an IRA?
I'll take it.
Okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Ramona.
Ramona?
No, so basically, I mean, the simplest form is an individual retirement account is sort of, you can set that up, make your investments and sort of diversify your portfolio by bonds, stocks, et cetera. An annuity is more like an insurance plan. You're putting it, let's say, $10,000 into it, and it's going to pay you back over time with a very particular interest rate. So it's much more like a bond in that way, whereas an IRA is an account in which you make investments into the stock market.
That's it. Yep. So let's, we have a question here. It's just on my screen here, so I'm just going to read it because I think it's a really good question. This is from Miles from Minneapolis. And what he writes is, I've given up on the credit score. The benefits of worrying about it don't seem to be worth it. So what do you think about this, Jaquette?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because I am curious to know how is the industry going to change and adjust in light of the fact that so many people's identity and credit has been compromised.
Right.
Almost every other month you hear of some huge data breach. So I get his frustration. Unfortunately, right now, that is the tool that a lot of financial organizations use to assess our credit worthiness. Depending upon what state in which you live, it might also be used as a tool for determining your employment. So while I see his point, I don't think we're at a juncture culturally to just abandon it and say, oh, I don't really care, I'm not going to worry about it. Because I think given that it is an important part of someone making an assessment of your credit worthiness and sometimes employment, it is what it is. And so you want to do everything possible to make sure that it is as high as possible.
So, Ramon, we may be getting past it, but it seems to me there was at least a period of time where people thought their credit score gave them some sort of notion of their moral worthiness. You know, if you had a high credit score, you were a good person. If you had a low credit score, you weren't a good person. I mean, what do you think about this whole credit scoring?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, fintech is going to be changing the credit score over time. Not immediately, but over time. There are now new sort of versions of credit scores that and companies that are creating sort of social credit scores. So it's not just based on your payments, but also who your friend circle is, you know, payments to bills and things and alternative sort of data input. So I think the credit score will change over time. I think that nowadays, especially among millennials, while people recognize it's important, there's not as much of a moral judgment. We all talk about no shame in the money game because a lot of times, you know, for a number of reasons, people have terrible credit scores, right? And you can always hit restart and you can try to bring that credit score back up, but it shouldn't be a moral judgment. It really is, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into it. But it's still very important, so I would still take care of it.
So a question for both of you. You know, so we're having this conversation, end of the year, thinking about your finances, looking ahead. And a natural question that arises is, should I hire a financial planner? Do I need a financial planner? So, Jaquette, at what point does someone need a financial planner? Or do they need a financial planner?
Well, you know, I think it is helpful to at least have someone provide you a second opinion. So there's a difference between having a financial planner that can do a one-time review and give you an assessment and provide some suggestions versus someone who's actually managing your money on an ongoing basis. And so I think a lot has to do with how complex is your financial life and how disciplined are you around certain things and also how engaged are you with your money. So I would say at a minimum, you're going to want to at least have someone review it and give you some suggestions and let you know if you are on course. That could be a one-time visit. And depending upon the complexity of your financial life and the degree to which you want to be actively engaged with your money determines whether or not that's an ongoing relationship and whether you are having them manage on your behalf or manage over your shoulder.
And Ramona?
Yeah, so I do believe that there's a point at which people in terms of their net worth and when you're managing, you know, if you've got 100
$6,000 in net worth, you probably want to see someone because there's some tax planning issues and there might be estate planning issues that come up. But I think early in life, particularly for millennials, and our mission as a company is really to empower people with the knowledge so that they can start making their own financial decisions. I think part of the confidence gap is that we've been told that you don't know anything about money and only the professionals do. And while there are certified financial planners that clearly know a lot about the sort of taxes and estate planning and how it works together, at the early stages in life, I think it's really important to just be able to understand how all of these complex things come together. And now with FinTech and the numerous different apps, you have that ability. So financial planning should be something that we think about from early on, and we should think about it in its most simplistic form, which is what's my relationship to money? What are the tools out there, and what are the sort of the resources and vehicles in which I can manage my money? And then later in life, you start to think about sort of the more complexities, and that's when I think you really need a sort of sit down. It doesn't have to be always. I mean, you can meet with a financial planner, you know, once a year. What I would say, though, is making sure that those folks are qualified. There's a lot of people in the financial planning space. Right. And so you just want to make sure that you're spending your money with the right person.
So this is someone who would...
making sure they're a fiduciary.
Right. So and the fiduciary is?
Someone who has who by law must make the sort of the best decision on your behalf there, so that they're not making decisions that sort of fill their pockets.
Exactly. Let's go to...
And Chris, if I can just add, I think what's really important is regardless of whether you hire someone for a one-time event or an ongoing event, that you never abdicate, right? It is still your money. And even though they may have an expertise in a particular area, do not be afraid to ask questions. And that could be a litmus test. Like if someone is not responsive to your questions, that can be a red flag that that's not really the right person for you to work with. And the analogy that I like to use is it's just like if you go to a doctor. The more questions you ask, the more you come in with your own knowledge base, the more that doctor can actually be of better service to you because it's then a co-partnership in your health and wellness. And the same is true when it comes to your money. You're going to them because they have a particular expertise, yes, but you cannot or you should not abdicate your power to them and just acquiesce and do whatever they do without question or whatever they suggest without question.
All right, let's go to the phones. We're running short on time, but let's go to James in St. Paul. And James, what's your comment?
And two quick points. First of all, we ought to be very leery about credit systems based on a social score that's already being used in China to control people's friendships and politics. The second thing is we know for a fact that state actors like China, North Korea, Russia, and others are undermining our credit and identity systems. And that is precisely the sort of thing that we have a Defense Department for.
Okay.
Is to protect us from...
That's taken us off in a different direction than I think. That's a different show. But it is, one of the things that I do think is important, and that's off the call that we got earlier, is in terms of protecting people, there is a role for our government to take identity theft more seriously. A little bit too much of it is, up to the individual to do. And, these are systems that we're trying to adjust to. So as we get to the end, one thing I want to do is really target, there's a lot of young people who graduated from college, their student loan debt payments have started, and because they're past that 6 months. And so in the minute we have left, just one quick piece of advice for young people starting to pay down their student loans. Jaquette?
Pay all of the minimum, and if you can pay even just $10 above the minimum, do that.
Ramona?
Consolidation, because oftentimes we have many loans, just to understand, consolidation can help you make one payment versus many payments.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed this hour.
Jaquette
Timmons.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jaquette Timmons is a financial behaviorist and author of Financial Intimacy. Ramona Ortega is founder and CEO of My Money, My Future, a financial tech company targeted at millennials.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks.